Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude, coming to you today as usual from Kialani here in Johannesburg, a sunny, lovely sunny autumn afternoon in Johannesburg as winter sort of knocks gently at the door. I hope you are all keeping well wherever you are. My guest this week is the veteran investigative journalist Sam Sol. He is the co-managing partner of the Amabungani, which is a non-profit investigative journalist team that has its roots in the Mail and Guardian newspaper. I've known Sam since the mid-1990s when he was working at the Sunday Tribune in Durban. We hadn't seen each other in quite a while. Over the years, the Amabungani team has played a major role in uncovering various aspects of state capture, but I do suggest, I mean, there's lots of stories. You can go to their website and check that out. Fascinating reading. So we discussed how the Amabungani came about, how they operate, how they choose the stories that they do cover, and then some of the challenges that he sees in facing sort of the media industry as a whole in South Africa, and just trying to work as journalists in an increasingly tough environment, both from a financial point of view, but also just a working environment that has become increasingly hostile recently. So, yeah, please enjoy now my chat with Sam. Sam, thanks for your time. We have been, I've been chasing you.
Yes.
But I know you've been quite...
Persistence is the first gift of journalism, or the secret of success, really.
I tell you, I do sort of go through those phases because I do chase a lot of people, and it's, you know, especially because I'm trying to release something every week, you know, and you suddenly, I find like with 2 days to go, no one's got back to me, and it becomes, well, you know, on deadline how that can be. And I still am sometimes a little bit uncomfortable in following up too often with people, but I appreciate it. And we got lucky because you're in Joburg and you're based in Durban, so that's cool. I was trying to think when our paths first crossed, and I think it was probably I was working at the Helen Sussman Foundation at the University of Natal, and you were at the Sunday Tribune. Does that make sense?
That's correct. I think the Helen Sussman Foundation have a publication, or the university had a publication?
It was called KZN Focus.
Yes,
writing and editing and I think I used to come and bug you for ideas, and bounce things off each other at that time. But what you were you the deputy editor already at that stage, were you just a hack?
I never rose to.
I got that wrong. Okay.
Heights. Yeah. I failed to be a company man. I eventually was the political editor for the Tribune. But I mean, at the time we first met, I was just a reporter for the Tribune.
But you were definitely working in that sort of beat, weren't you? I mean, you were following the stories of the violence and
yes,
the politics.
Yes, I was interested in politics and violence in KZN at the time.
Because particularly in that post-election period, there was, I mean, particularly I think Richmond was quite a hot zone at that time, wasn't it?
It was, and I think, I mean, that was
even maybe and Cabinda and all that crazy
pre-election, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, of course, yeah, definitely. But it just kind of went on and on there for quite some time. And I suppose we see now, if not a continuation, certainly a resurgence of that political violence in KwaZulu-Natal again, although obviously it's a bit murkier, I suppose, this time around.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't made a sort of study of it, so I'm not an expert, but there seem to be a lot of the same types of people involved in picking off opponents, political opponents, and you know, I think it's all about resources and access to power and to the, you know, the resources that power brings.
Mm, yeah, which I suppose, I mean, we'll discuss that as we go, but you're now. What is your, because you belong to this investigative journalist collective, could I call it that? I'm not sure even how to define Amabungani.
Okay,
because you're not a newspaper as such. Are you a resource for newspapers, or what is it exactly?
Okay, so we're an independent non-profit company, and I'm on the co-managing partner. That's Stefan Brimmer and I founded it, set it up. Originally, it grew out of the investigative unit or team at the Mail and Guardian that he and I both formed part of. And we wanted to expand, and we were also interested in kind of leaving a legacy in a way. And it was clear that the Mail and Guardian didn't have any money. They never had any money. So we went to them with a proposition. The money that you put into the unit as it exists, the salaries, the overheads, the costs, put that money in a pot and give it to us, put it into the non-profit company. We will, on that basis, go out and raise donor funding to do investigative journalism, to do training, and to do advocacy work. That was always the kind of the three pillars on which we based the organization. And for the Mail and Guardian's input, they would have the kind of right of first refusal.
First dibs on whatever we produced. When was this then?
That was, we started setting it up in 2009, and our first Amawungani story was, in fact, Zuma Incorporated, all the sort of companies associated with Zuma and his extended family. And that was published in 2010. I can't remember exactly when. That was the first story under the Amawungani byline.
But you were still quite close to the Mail and Guardian then.
Absolutely. So then when we set up there, what they contributed was two-thirds of our budget. The arrangement was they just kept pace with inflation, and in fact, in latter years they fell behind that. But we then, you know, from the first donor, which was the Open Society Foundation, you know, we extended that quite successfully, and by the time we parted company, which was just about 2.5 years ago.
I think that's when I last saw you, yeah.
Their contribution was about 30%, 30 maybe a third of our budget. So we'd grown the budget quite considerably. When we parted ways, we lost that 30%. We tightened our belts a bit, and we've filled the gap through crowdfunding, smaller donations, not from big foundations, although some of them are quite substantial. And that forms about 20% of our budget now from crowdfunding. And the aim is to try to push that up to 50%, so that, you know, to sell the idea of public interest journalism that people are prepared to pay for. But it's not behind a paywall. It's purely voluntary. You get access to everything for free. The donation is kind of a support, a signal of support. And the way we work is we give the content away, but that gives us editorial control. We decide where it goes. We decide if we're not happy about how it's going to be used. You know, we own it. It's a mutual sign-off because our publishing contracts with publishing partners, the liability that they assume is legal liability. If we get sued, they pay the bills because... So there has to be... They must be happy with the story as well,
right?
Because if there's a problem,
they
take the legal bills. So it works pretty well.
That's good cover for you then, yes. Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, because lawyers' expenses are enormous.
Yeah.
And, you know, just one big case could put us out of business.
Yeah. You haven't I mean, I suppose you might as well jump right into this because I mean you're seen as quite, I suppose, almost as an enemy of the state in some circles, the Amar Bongani, for the work you've done in exposing corruption and the like. Particularly, I suppose we would say, well, you've been around since 2010, so that would cover the bulk of the Jacob Zuma era. How do you decide what stories to cover?
Look, it's a difficult juggling act. You know, there are few of us. Our skill set is not uniform. Some people are good at some things and not at others. Others are, you know, good at more things. Some have particular interests and enthusiasms, and so you have to work with what you've got. It also depends on information coming in. Mm. But we try to make strategic choices because there's so much happening in the country. Yeah, there's exactly. So That's, much
yeah.
Corruption, mismanagement, abuse across the spectrum. So you have to try and work out.
And that's in the sort of public and private sector as well, isn't
yes.
it? I mean, I see you do have, you're investigating at the moment sort of election funding, tender corruption in metros, the Steinhoff, ongoing Steinhoff saga, I suppose we can call it that, PR companies, lottery payouts, and the Public Investment Corporation. I suppose
Look, that's what quite we, a what
wide
we did
range.
And what we do is we kind of have a lechotla or a bosberaad once a year, and we have what somebody else walked in and saw us with a marker board and pens and so on with these three circles in a Venn diagram, and they dubbed it the Circle of Hate. And basically we look at business, politics, and crime, and where those three intersect, in a sense, is the sweet spot or the sour spot, because where those three intersect, I think, does the most damage to the society, to the state. Mm. And state capture and the Guptas fit right in there. I mean, our first story that we published under the Amar Bongani name was a look at Jacob Zuma and his extended family and their business interests, and the Guptas were there. We didn't know how important they were then, but they were one of the sort of
the names that came up
and the sort of business people circulating, you know, along with Sheikh and you know other people, Vivian Reddy. But you know, they were on and off the radar screen, and we published quite a lot on them long before the Gupta leaks came along. Mm. And I think that you know, the state capture represented you know, an existential threat to the democracy, the democratic project. And you know, we're very proud of what we did there. We make no apologies. I think post Gupta leaks, you know, we had to look around and reassess what are the priorities now. And I think we're still struggling a bit with that. Mm-hmm. The Guptas are not quite gone. I think, you know. But the Fight Back campaign, the issues around the enormous damage done to the state, you know, is particularly in the energy space, is something that we want to kind of get into, and we do want to get into looking at corporates more, which we took a very deliberate decision to devote quite serious resources to looking at Steinhoff. And I think we, you know, before the report of the audit, forensic audit was published, I mean, we published stuff that was groundbreaking on Steinhoff, showing that, you know, what Marcus Juster did more recently was kind of a pattern that had been established way back. But I think our focus on the state and state institutions was very important because, in a sense, if the state fails, well, all the rest of the bets are off. Yeah. The state is the only institution that can manage and control the private sector, really. And if the state is frayed and dysfunctional, then nothing else works. Yeah.
So, I mean, are you sort of insinuating there that Steinhoff is not only part of a sort of personal corruption, but a lack of oversight by state institutions that should be monitoring large corporations? Or
look, absolutely. I mean, you know, the fact that Steinhoff got, you know, these huge investments from the Public Investment Corporation is a big issue. The fact that, you know, not just locally, but globally, the kind of institutions of private sector surveillance and accountability, you know, really didn't work in a spectacular fashion. And there were, you know, there were lots of, if one looked at it, there were lots of red flags, and there were people who pointed that out before the crash.
I suppose another common denominator, both in the sort of public and private sector, if we're talking state capture or corporate corruption, is the role of the big four accounting firms and how they've kind of somehow turned a blind eye or just been deliberately incompetent? And that's not even a problem that we face in South Africa. I mean, you read about these guys' behavior all over the world. I mean, even in the UK now, there's efforts to try and break these companies up because they just seem to be amok.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, they operate in a sort of structural conflict of interest where, you know, they make a lot of money from their consulting, and that, you know, on the other side of the Chinese wall, they're supposed to be policing these companies. But look, when we looked at the Gupta leaks, we made a very specific decision to look at the enablers, you know, the lawyers, accountants, and other kinds of fixers, without whom, you know, these very large frauds are not possible. You know, people are dealing in cash or whatever. You know, there's only so much stuff that you can steal in cash. When you really want to steal, you have to have companies and accountants and lawyers and so on. And you know, I think, again, the way we exposed KPMG in that case, but, you know, others as well, was important. I think, again, it's part of a global process of trying to force those, you know, people in suits, to have some accountability. Mm-hmm. And I do think there needs to be a structural change. I think that much of what auditors do now and charge for could be automated, could be done by AI.
Algorithms.
Algorithms. And the algorithms would throw up red flags,
which would kick in a process where auditors,
you know, do proper investigations and so on, rather than, you know, doing, certifying the accounts on a test basis. I mean, any reasonably large company now, you know, it's possible to have a program that monitors the cash flow in real time. And that should be
standard operating procedure. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about just the sort of state of the press. Funnily enough, I spoke to Pippa Green. She's the newly appointed. She's the press ombudsman for South Africa now. When we spoke just a couple of weeks back, South Africa, according to the Press Freedom Index, was 28th in the world and now has slipped to 31. Although I did see that in 2013 we were as low down as 52 in terms of the Press Freedom Index from the journalists, Reporters Without Borders, I think the people that came up with that. So still not bad, but there's been a bit of a slip. And I'm just trying to get a sense, I would like to get a sense from you, you working in a pretty fraught environment, but there have been sort of particularly, well, not particularly, I suppose, both from sort of non-state players and political representatives, attacks, quite sort of not violent, but verbal hounding, if I could call it that, on journalists. And I'm just wanting to get a sense from you as how you see the state of press freedom in this country. I suppose it becomes a little bit jacked up now in the initial, in the sort of pre-election phase, but just in your experience over the last couple of years.
Look, I mean, I do think the environment is slowly getting more and more hostile.
It's kind of a global trend as well.
It is a global trend as well, and I think, you know, partly it's some of the similar trends, the kind of populist politics, whether it's, you know, left wing populism or right wing populism. The media is an easy target, along with other, you know, kind of scapegoats, the way in which social media has developed is, you know, both state actors and other significant political actors are able to, with relatively few resources financially, you know, bypass the media and, you know, essentially have a quite a sophisticated and quite a widespread propaganda campaign, which partly relies on undermining the media and, you know, questioning the facts or the spin that the media is putting on things. So globally, it's a hostile environment here as well. I think the major problem is that the funding model for journalism is broken. Google, Facebook, and Amazon are eating everybody's advertising lunch, and, you know, the advertising dollars that paid for journalism are being sucked up by these platforms who are not spending any money on journalism. And, you know, now in this country, I mean, there are just so few boots on the ground. It's not about good journalists or bad journalists. They're just so few.
Not enough journalists.
Yeah, they really are. And you've had a particularly bad situation in relation to independent media, which was, maybe still is, the biggest newspaper group in the country. And, you know, the ANC for years, you know, threatened the media tribunal, and I think they eventually realized, well, actually we can just buy the media, or buy the most important single voice other than the SABC, which they did, using public PLC money, the Public Investment Corporation money, which was a straight kind of political decision in terms of how much was paid. Unfortunately, that company has been, you know, has been run down in all sorts of ways. The PIC is never going to get their money back. There's been just slash and burn retrenchments. A very valuable public institution that was there, exploited as it was by the Irish. The process started under the Irish owners.
Tony O'Reilly.
That has just accelerated.
Stripping.
Yeah, that's accelerated under Iqbal Survey, you know, to the point where there's not much left, and that has really, you know, a huge impact
on the sort of institution of the press in the country.
You know, we're in a lucky position where, you know, we do you know, high-profile investigations. We're sexy. We can fund ourselves from big foundations and from, you know, public crowdfunding. But the media infrastructure, the media ecosystem, requires more than just us. Mm. You know, the whole Gupta Frieda Dairy Free State thing. That started out from a report from the small Afrikaans newspaper in the Free State, and those, you know, those local papers, those city papers, I mean, globally, are just disappearing. And that's
Daily Dispatch.
Yeah, that's the foundation of, you know, accountability journalism is local reporting, and there's less and less of it, and you know we build on all of that, and
right.
You know the whole
you kind
basis
of rely on that grassroots,
yeah, exactly, and the whole basis of having an informed citizenry is built on from the bottom up. You know, it doesn't. It's nice to have the Gupta leaks and the stuff at the top, but that's not an accountability system.
What do you think? I know, for example, the Guardian newspaper over the last couple of years has been one that's a very sort of fierce drive to get their subscriber numbers up, and particularly on the online, you know, there's a definite shift to online and sort of making money online, but. What do you think needs to happen for the mainstream media in South Africa to sort of find its feet again in this sort of very fraught environment of not only falling subscriptions but falling advertising revenues?
Look, I don't think there's a clever answer. I think everybody's doing what they can to survive, but I think that, frankly, the solutions are structural and political. Basically, you know, there have to be ways found to make the big platforms pay or divert some of the advertising, you know, to local sources. Google should be broken up. You know, Amazon should be broken up. Facebook should be broken up. But beyond that, they're
so
probably...
So it's kind of at that global level,
yeah,
that something needs to
global,
happen. It's like
global
way beyond our control.
Well,
here.
Well, look, I'm not sure, you know, because I think...
Tiso, Black Star, and...
I think that...
Independent.
Some of those things could be started locally. Up to now, up to very recently, sort of global service providers haven't charged and haven't paid VAT here. That's just very recently been changed by SARS regulations coming in and so on. So I think there are ways to, you know, if global players want to operate here, then they have to play according to rules. But the rules have to be put in place. Mm. And I think globally there probably has to be some recognition that, and, France does it in a way, I don't know how successfully, that journalism is a public good and it needs public funding, just as public broadcasters need public funding.
Mm. Like a public transport system.
Yeah, and there needs to be a way found to do that without giving politicians, you know, a say as to who runs something and
what gets reported or
what gets reported.
That's because that's of course that editorial freedom must still be obviously the mainstay of any.
Absolutely.
Press institution at whatever level. How did you start out in journalism, Sam? That's a long time ago.
I started off freelancing for Dennis Beckett.
Frontline.
For Frontline magazine.
Yeah, I've been trying to track him down for this podcast, actually.
I came to Joburg. I had a job interview with the Business Times. The interview went very badly.
Had you trained as a journalist?
No.
You just wanted to write?
I'm a university dropout.
Did your military service, as we were told about.
Yes, after dropping out, then I had to make a decision about whether I was you know, going to go overseas and stay there. In fact, I did go overseas and then decide to come back, and did 2 years in the infantry as a rifleman. And that was a very unpleasant experience, but I think as I explained in the piece I wrote for Iqbal Survey, it was a very politicizing experience, very educational experience, taught me a lot, taught me about the sharp end of apartheid, which is a young, you know, middle-class white boy you didn't really see. I went to school in Cape Town, was at boarding school at Saks. And it taught me about power, about institutions of power, you know, hierarchies.
Violence.
Taught me, you know, resistance. Taught me a lot of things. And I wrote my first piece of journalism while I was in the army still. I had known Janet Cherry at university.
Yeah. Okay.
And I bumped into her. And at that stage...
She was a doctor, right? Is that correct?
She's a political scientist now.
Oh, okay. That name rings a bell.
Her brother was a doctor, a biologist, I think. She was big in the End Conscription campaign.
Right, okay.
So when I
bumped... She was an activist.
She was an activist, yeah. She was detained. But I bumped into her and... We had just started to spend some time in the townships under the first state of emergency, and it's probably 85.
Yeah, 85. 85.
Jesus. And, you know, so I explained what was going on, and I kind of agreed that I would write something, and she gave me an address. And so I wrote something by hand, and I went into town. Grahamstown, I was at 6th South African Infantry, outside Grahamstown. I went into Grahamstown one Sunday on a pass, and I posted this to the address.
handwritten.
Handwritten. And it was then published. I only discovered, I mean, much later, where, you know, it was published in the International Herald Tribune.
What had you written?
It was basically an account of the troops in the townships, what was going on.
Right.
Just like an eyewitness account. And it was my first piece of journalism. It wasn't under a byline, obviously. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I would have got into a lot of trouble.
Hmm.
It was my first and most successful piece of journalism. I've never published anything in the International Herald Tribune.
Since.
Okay,
so you then went to work with Dennis Beckett at Frontline. And that was a kind of, would you call it an alternative?
Well, Dennis is a maverick.
It's like okay.
But what was nice is that he was interested in writing. He was interested in different points of view. I was interested in stories. Like, you know, a serious magazine in some ways. So I did some work for him, and then I did other things just to make ends meet. I did some more freelancing. And then I did a freelance piece for the Sunday Tribune, and which they liked. And then those days, they actually had a bureau in Johannesburg.
Hmm.
So they invited me to come and work, you know, once a week on Saturdays in the bureau to kind of get a sense of me and a feel for proper journalism. And then they offered me a job down in Durban, and that's how I started out.
So where are you from originally then?
I was born in Pretoria, and I went to school in Cape Town.
Okay, and then you lived in Durban for many years?
Yeah, I lived in Durban now.
You're still there, yeah?
I'm still there.
So you're from all over the place?
Yeah.
Just I want to get back now into the sort of whole nature of investigative journalism, as you alluded to the fact that I suppose some of your work depends a lot, or the success of your work with Amma Bongani depends a lot on having information and sources. And so, I mean, I don't want to, if you don't want to discuss too much of this, but, you know, the process of particularly in this era of state security agencies, fake news. How do you kind of, I mean, what processes do you put in place to ensure that, you know, you're not being played as part of some other game?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. Because, I mean,
you've done work now about the SAPS, a series on, and I can imagine that must be pretty tricky to kind of navigate.
Yeah, I mean,
particularly when you're dealing with those kinds of people. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds
where crime and police.
It sounds cynical, but I mean, and I'm not a cynic, but you know, the longer I'm a journalist, the more you realize there are no good guys really. there are just sort of less bad and more bad. But those distinctions are important, and I think it's journalistically it's very nice because we all want good guys and heroes and so on, and sometimes it's easy to fall into that trap of painting something as all white or all black, mostly it's gray.
Very gray.
But the distinctions within that grayness are important. You know,
light gray and dark gray.
Yeah, it's not the same thing. And shit. Whatever I've tried to publish has been my sort of best version of the truth. I'm sure I haven't always got it right, but that's what one aims to. Or if you don't know, then you know you say you don't know.
Yeah.
But look, to some extent, there's two issues around, you know, being played. I think quite a lot of South African politics has been run or played by manipulating the media, by leaking scandals against one side or the other. And I do think that the media has been insufficiently alive to that. Some of the problems that the Sunday Times got into, for instance,
SARS rogue unit,
particularly, you know, has been by being particularly too attached to one narrative or one particular side or one set of sources or whatever, and I think it's easy for that to happen. But I mean, I do think I think. You know, maybe some of the criticisms, for instance, of the Cato Manor stories have been perhaps now overplayed as well. You know, that story in some people's eyes has been completely discredited. I'm not sure that's fair as well.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's something, it's a kind of a trap that we all fall into because, you know, but maintaining the balance between, you know, not giving a source too much power over, you know, you don't own the story. You know, the moment the source wants to kind of determine the story, then one really has to be very careful. So that's the one point. In terms of how we deal with that, and it also goes to the issue of sources. I mean, people often think that, you know, I have an amazing contact book and I can phone up people and get, you know, confidential information, and that's, you know, usually not so. So what we do is we try to be proactive. We try to choose what stories to do before they become a kind of a media scrum or before somebody comes to us. Or even if somebody comes to us, we've hopefully
got some
flagged that issue as a key issue.
Right.
And we've done some homework.
You've got a sense of what...
So we've got a sense of some of the players, some of the background, etc. And both in terms of not being played, but also in terms of getting sources and getting people to talk to you and trust. You know, the most important thing that you can do is your homework. So I mean, very often we'll go to be people quite cold. And, you know, the most likely that they're going to talk to you is if they get a sense of you're serious because you've done your homework, you know some of the background, you know some of the players, you know.
You're not just fishing.
You're not just waiting for a sound bite. And our other advantage, which, you know, again, because of our funded model, we can afford to be patient. So there are people who we all approach and who are, you know, not ready to talk, or and then things change, they fall out with people, or, you know, and we're in a position to wait and go back to people, or wait until they're ready. So those are some of the techniques. Other journalists don't have that luxury
of time.
But that's why we raise the money, so that we do have time. I mean, Craig McCune, you know, worked on that Steinhoff thing for about four or five months.
Yeah.
You know, not doing much.
It's just unheard of in a newsroom today.
Not doing much else. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you have a preference over getting a cache of documents to a interview with a good source, or do you need both of those for a story to really stick?
You do need both of those, because it's quite rare that people will go on the record, and I think if the information is serious and seriously damaging, you're asking people to take. To take a significant risk for at least for their livelihood. You know, the record for whistleblowers is a very bad one.
Yeah.
So in terms of how you manage sources, it's normally you as an experienced journalist have probably been in that position much more often than the source. So it's kind of a responsibility that you have,
right,
to kind of offer
almost
them
like a
informed,
handler kind of
informed consent in a way, rather than say, yes, give it to me and publish and I'll move on to the next one and you get fired. Sorry. Well,
yeah, you know, it's quite a dance that you.
So you kind of have a responsibility to make people aware of the possible consequences and to think about, you know, how else can we do this that doesn't expose them, and so on.
Yeah, I've written down here whistleblowers, and I just wanted to get your sort of sense of, I mean, it seems to be, again, we go back to the sort of global issue, and I don't want to sort of put everything just on the fact that it's because it's a global issue, we shouldn't deal with it locally as well. But I mean, whistleblowers, as you say, the track record is not that great. You have all these governments purporting to support whistleblowers. You have companies even saying, you know, come forward, bloody, bloody, blah. But, I mean, from Swiss banks to the NSA in the United States, I mean, people normally end up in jail.
Yeah.
For doing what they would think is a public service.
You know, at the very least, you know, losing their job, having, you know, litigation,
public vilification.
Yeah.
What do we? How do you make that environment more? How do you make the press environment more whistleblower friendly, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I think the Whistleblower Act, the Protected Disclosures Act, could be beefed up. I think it has been amended. I'm not sure whether the amendment has been gazetted. We fought quite hard for more enhanced protections than we got. I think it is a bit better than it was. But yes, companies and governments and so on are really hypocritical about whistleblowing.
You're saying the commissions of inquiry now have perhaps set an important precedent in that sense?
Absolutely. I think people have kind of witnessed the social value of insiders coming forward. It's also been important that the commissions have kind of set up a safe space where, nobody can at least overtly be punished for going to give evidence at the commission kind of thing. But I think it is always hard, and as a journalist, one needs to be very, very careful about trying to persuade people to become whistleblowers in a sense of that their identity becomes known.
What the sort of consequences at a very basic level are going to be.
Yeah, because, they're more than likely going to lose their job, and you as a journalist can't do anything to protect them, essentially. Mm. The Gupta leaks was the most extraordinary experience in that regard. Because what happened was the sources came to us via Branko Brucic from Daily Maverick. He hooked up with Stefans. I didn't even know about it at that stage. And when they looked at the sample material, the sources had prepared some extracts from the leaks to show this is what we've got. And when they looked at that sample, it was clear both that, look, this is genuine, and also this is potentially really damaging to the health of the sources, the whistleblowers. And we actually can't do anything unless we put them out of harm's way. They would have been in harm's way. And there were basically two families. And to relocate two families is not like just air tickets. And we didn't have the resources to do that. So we had to go around looking for funding to protect these whistleblowers, to relocate them, etc. We've never done anything like that. It's not something that's very easy to do. It had some consequences in terms of the security of the project, because we had to go around to a series of rich people
to let people know.
If you want to ask someone for $1 million, they want to know
just a little bit of detail,
a little bit of whether this is real or not. So that was extremely. It was unprecedented for us. It was the most difficult part of the whole process. Mm. But successful. Hopefully.
I just want to get a sense of you're off to Lusaka now. You tell me to run a workshop. Is that correct?
Right.
I just want to get a sense from you. I was just reading again in this Press Freedom Index. I think Namibia has the freest press, according to that index. I think they're in position number 23 of African countries. Still quite it seems to be a tough place for particularly journalists doing your kind of work. Although, in Ethiopia, I think they advanced 30 or 40 positions. The Gambia as well have made some leaps. But there is still quite an oppressive sort of environment for journalists operating in Africa. What sort of support can you give, and how do you kind of cooperate? What sort of mutual support do you offer and receive from other investigative type structures across the continent, and how important is that?
Look, I think when we started, as I said, the three pillars were sort of training, doing best practice investigative journalism, doing training, or passing on the skills, and advocacy. And as part of passing on the skills, we raised funding to have internships. At that stage, when we started, we had quite a lot of funding. We used to have two or three at any one time. One from South Africa, and one or two from SADC, the SADC region. For some reason, that funding has dried up quite a lot. So some of that, we still have some funding for outreach, which is what I'm doing, going to do stuff there rather than people coming to us. But it was very effective because journalists would come from Namibia or Botswana, Malawi or whatever, spend 3 months with us. We'd pay them a stipend, which was generally more than they were getting at home. Certainly not necessarily at in Namibia, but certainly most of the other SADC countries. And they'd work with us. They'd have some mentoring, but they'd also be exposed, you know, to the way we work,
processes,
yeah. To debates about ethics and issues and so on. So some of our graduates then went back and, you know, were no longer satisfied with the environment in which they were working in their home publications, because we didn't take people from university or whatever. We took working journalists,
right,
and they came to us for 3 months, and whatever they produced was also published in their home publication.
Right.
So to give a bit of an incentive to the publications to let them go for 3 months, but people went back and wanted to carry on having the
kind of
freedom
work.
And that kind of work, and so the Namibian always had their own investigative team, but we took a series of people from them, and I think, you know, help them beef that up. And in fact, they are following our model in the next while. In Botswana, a couple of our graduates got together, resigned, got funding, and started up the Inc. Center,
okay.
Investigative Journalist Center in Botswana. There's a crowd that have started up in Swaziland. There's some individual journalists who are trying to get something underway in Zambia. That's partly why I'm going. There is Lesotho as well. There's a small group. But the real difficulty is funding. And I think what also we've realized is the resources, both, you know, the skills base and the financial resources to set up and run a small company are significant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, journalists in the rest of Africa are incredibly under-resourced. So, you know, when we go there, it's more about trying to shift the goalposts a bit within their own organizations. Give them some skills, some insights, some kind of enthusiasm, idea of the possibilities, and hopefully shift their own organizations where they work a little bit. You know, it goes back to your issue around the kind of capture of the media and getting too close to sources and so on. And, you know, unfortunately, journalism in a lot of the rest of Africa is quite tied to a particular side. You have a businessman who supports a particular party and, you know, and then his journalists are expected to kind of toe that line.
Right.
And, you know, then when, you know, that patron, you know, is out of power, then you know, there's a crackdown on that publication and so on.
Mm.
And, you know, it's very difficult for us to lecture people in that environment. People don't, you know, don't have cars to go to, you know, go to press conferences or anything. And, you know, there's a culture of, you know, if people want to have a press conference, then there's a little package of cash for every journalist who comes to the press conference. Mm. And, you know, if people use that to put petrol that, in their cars, it's quite, you know, it's quite hard to criticize. So you're dealing with a media environment that is, you know, often much more hostile or difficult financially, ethically, you know, professionally than we have. And there's not, you know, what we do have here is a legal framework and very strong judicial backing for the role of the media here, which has given us a really important backstop. And, you know, many African journalists don't have that. So, you know, to the extent that we can help, we try. We also kind of do some cross-border collaborations. When they come and work with us, if they do an internship, they can often do stories and publish them here that they wouldn't be able to do when they were at home. And sometimes we do those stories without a byline, mm-hmm. so that they don't get into trouble when they go back, that kind of thing. And then, you know, if stories are published in the South African media, then they're kind of legitimately picked up in, you know, in Lesotho.
On the feed, as it were.
On the feed, and then, you know, so the story gets out.
Mm.
But it's a difficult in environment.
Mm. So I suppose that's important to put, as you say, I mean, to put the sort of state of South African journalism in a, or the press or media as a whole, in that sort of context where we are in, would you say, fairly good shape?
Look, as I was saying, I think that, you know, the idea of journalism in this country is in good shape. You know, I think that people don't, they underestimate how well they are served, they have been served by the media in this country. There have been some mistakes, but on the whole, you know, in terms of the role media is supposed to play as one of the pillars of democracy, I think we're incredibly lucky. But I think what people also don't realize and understand is what a thin line that is. There are really, really few people holding that line. I think that the kind of recapture of the SABC, you know, from the Zuma riots and from Cloudy was really important. The SABC is still the most important
source. Just in terms of its reach.
Its
and
reach, source
capacity.
Of news and journalism.
Yeah. Multilingual.
But there seems to be another fight to bring the SABC back within the orbit of kind of political control. Mm. And, you know, journalists at the SABC need public support to kind of hold the line again. Mm. They're a really important resource. I think the collapse of print media is important because, by its nature, and I'm not talking just about the paper print, but by its nature, print media is able to get into things in more depth. And I think the broadcast media feed off that. It's always been the print media that kind of breaks the stories, has set the news agenda to a large extent.
You're talking about an old-fashioned newsroom in a newspaper, kind of.
And so, you know, the SABC is important, but I think the loss of that kind of first move resources is difficult. Daily Maverick is growing. I think it's one of the they seem to have reached kind of critical mass. Strength to them. But I do think, as I said, the whole model needs to be looked at as to how we get more boots on the ground that are not, you know, dependent on kind of political masters.
Sam, thanks so much for your time this evening. It's great to catch up with you.
It's a great pleasure. Good luck with the podcast.
I hope you enjoyed that. He did come across as calm and committed. He's, you know, obviously the work they've been doing has put them under some pressure over the last years or so, but he's certainly committed to the work that Amar Bongani do here in South Africa and also supporting investigative journalism across the region. I was interested to hear how they were sort of also, I suppose, some political parties in the country are coping with the post-Zuma era, how they are now sort of shifting their focus as well and will be concentrating more on corporate South Africa. It'll be interesting to see how that works. Also, you know, the importance that he puts on having the time and patience to cover the stories that they do, a luxury that's missing from many newsrooms, not only here in South Africa, but around the world. Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. Please also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating or comment, and that will help to spread the word about the podcast. You can also find Voices from SA on Spotify, Deezer, Radio Public, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.